Good afternoon. It is 12:02 on a cloudy but overall nice day. It's Monday, and I'm Eric Scott here on WASR. We'll have a little something different today. Often in this slot is Wolfboro Police Chief Dean Rondo, but today I have some people involved in a great fundraiser and a lot of fun. With me, I have New Hampshire playwright Jay McNamee, Kathleen Hill, the producer of one of the producers of the play Dying with Laughter, and Barbara Wilson is with me also. And want to thank all you guys for coming in and making the time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for inviting us.
You can relax, really. We make it painless. We do. Nobody bites. So anyway, thank you again for all making the time. The play is called Dying with Laughter. It's a joint fundraiser for the Village Players Theater and Granite VNA. So Mr. McNamee, I guess the first thing would be to ask with you is tell me a little bit about how this got started.
It actually got started at a college reunion about, 25 years ago.
Okay.
And a friend of mine, it was in June of 2002, and a friend of mine showed up at the reunion having survived the attack on the Twin Towers,
mm-hmm.
and told me a phenomenal story about how people came to each other's aid selflessly and at great danger to themselves. And because of that, his group was able to escape. And I'd always been thinking about writing a little short piece about 9/11, and I didn't know how to approach it without making it a historical drama of some kind. So his story gave me the impetus to come up with one short play, which I wrote, and then it was read at the next reunion 5 years later, which also happened to have, as part of the schedule, a panel discussion with a Dr. Ira Byock, who's one of the world's leading palliative care specialists.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fascinated by that, and I read his book and found some other stories that I thought were worth talking about. So I started picking away at these sort of end-of-life scenarios over the course of the next few years, but I couldn't help but find humor in almost all of them. That's just my nature.
I was going to say, I hesitate to call it a comedy.
They are comedies. Just because something's a comedy doesn't mean it can't touch your heart as well.
Right.
And there's a lot of humor in here and a lot of pathos. And ultimately, I hope that they're uplifting and affirming as opposed to sad and unhappy.
Right. Why do you think that is? And I want to ask all three of you that question. And I know it has nothing to do with the play, but it has to do with the inspiration of it. End-of-life care in this country is, shall we say, not the most efficient, pleasant thing on the face of the planet. How easy is it, or how hard is it, to take a look at that and find humor in that? Obviously, you do.
Well, yeah, I tend to find humor in everything.
Okay.
I hope I don't cross the line and offend people. It's the human condition is such that I think we recognize ourselves in scenes up on the stage, and we get a little perspective being able to sit in the audience and say, oh, you know what? Yeah, that is kind of funny. Because it's not me, it's somebody else.
Right.
But we see ourselves in there, and I think it's a good way to get a message across. If you're trying to preach to the audience, you're not going to have much of an impact on them. They're going to turn off and go to sleep. But if you can tickle their funny bones a little bit and just let that message sort of sneak past their safety shields, then it tends to have a better impact. And you're right, the way we handle end of life in the United States, but the Western world in general, is not healthy. So.
Oh, I agree.
I think it's humor that helps you get through those tough times. And it's hard if you can't find some humor there. And I personally have twice been told you're not going to make it. And I'm still here. But even then, in real life, finding the humor in the situation is really the only way to make it through.
And I think that one of the really striking things about this production is that people are going to be in a theater full of other people, and we're all going to recognize ourselves or our own situations at various times. Mm-hmm. Like the character who says, why shouldn't I smoke? I'm going to be dying anyway. And a cigarette gives me relaxation that I don't get anywhere else. Right. And, you know, all of a sudden we as caretakers say, well, why shouldn't they have that huge bowl of chocolate ice cream? They're in a different place now. And I think the nice thing about a theater, not only are you with a lot of people, but you're also in the darkness. So if you need to shed a tear, or if you're laughing thinking, maybe this is a little inappropriate, nobody else is going to know.
Right. How did the players get together with you, Mr. McNamee?
I was building a house in New Durham, and on my frequent runs to Bradley's to collect the various nuts and bolts I'd forgotten to buy that morning, I was driving by a building on South Street that Central New Hampshire V&A was renovating. And I said, oh, I'd like to help them raise some funds for that renovation, and maybe we could do a reading of my play and just make it a little fundraiser kind of thing. I'm new to the area, so I don't know any of the actors or performers up here. And so I went right to the Village Players and said, hey, is there something we could do? Would you do a reading? And they said, no, we'd like to do a full production.
Okay.
So, yeah. And then COVID hit.
And
everything went on pause for a couple of years. And then this past, I guess it was like January or,
mm-hmm.
yeah, we all got together again, the folks from Granite V&A and the Village Players, and said, yeah, let's do this.
What is it about this play? It's been aged in the wood, as it were, between the various delays and you writing it and then with COVID. Is it? Wow, I can actually hear the birds. Oh, that's pretty cool. You know it's spring.
Yes.
Even with headphones on, I can hear them. Is it? I'm trying to think of the way I. Of course, the birds distracted me. when you put it all together, how much has it changed between its original genesis and its presentation with the Village Players?
Yeah, I've written more than the seven pieces that are being presented in this production. My first draft, I did a reading in Portsmouth as a benefit for a hospice on the seacoast.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched the audience reaction to the pieces. And a couple of the pieces were just a little harsh and too hard for people to take. And the problem with that is it then puts them off emotionally to not be able to appreciate the next piece because they come within 10 minutes of each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I killed a couple of those and just stuck them in the bottom drawer somewhere and wrote a couple of new ones. And some of these have never been performed ever. Others were performed as part of the Newburyport Festival of New Works. And so some of them have been stage tested, others are brand new.
It's kind of neat. We actually have an actress who was in Newburyport who's in the production up here. Mm-hmm. In Do I Look Like Your Wife? Tajora Davis is going to be in it.
Yeah, she was in the first production of the first piece I ever wrote. So it's kind of interesting. And then to see her name appear on the cast list, I had no idea that anybody up here, I guess Kathleen had worked with her. So.
I did. Yeah, I worked with her at the Winnipesaukee Playhouse many years ago, and I just happened to say, hey, are you interested in coming up? And she said, I'd love to do that again, and especially since it's a fundraiser, I'd be happy to come back and perform.
It's interesting, we're going to be able to have a Q&A after each of the productions. So mm-hmm. if anybody in the audience wanted to ask Tajora what she's seen change or what she and herself has changed since she was in it first. She said she feels like she's brought more depth to it, but I, for one, would like to know more about mm-hmm. that to have her expound on it.
I think so. I've been involved from the beginning of getting directors for each short play has its own director. And cast. And so we came together to talk about what the process should be. And I've directed a lot of plays, and at first I started like saying, well, you could do this and you could do that. And Paul Stewart, who was the other producer, reminded me that I wasn't a director, so I should be quiet. And so I have all these ideas about what these should look like in my own head. And it will be very interesting to see what each director and each cast brought to the play. Because if you go to see plays directed by different directors, they're never the same twice. And so it'll be interesting to see what everybody brings. I'm very excited about it.
What does a producer do exactly?
So the producer is the organization behind the show. So the director might say, we need this, this, and this. And the producer finds somebody to get the props or somebody to do the lights.
And
they're sort of the organizer of the whole thing.
They make it happen.
On one level, yes. I mean, there are lots of people who make it happen, but
right.
The producer kind of pulls all those pieces together.
Right. And in a play, what does the director do?
So the director is the person who works with the actors to say, this is how I'd like you to play this, or this is how I would like you to move during this, when you're making this speech. And they're sort of, really, the director is, at least at the Village Players, the director is in charge, and the producer helps to get what the director needs.
Okay.
So it's a real collaboration.
Okay. And Barbara, how did you get involved with the Players?
Originally?
Originally.
Oh, okay. Well, the Granite State News had an article about the production of Oliver. Mm-hmm. And I had some little kids in my house who would like to be in Oliver. And so for many years, I was just a stage mom. And then gradually, I've done a few other things. And for this show, I get to try to find the people who this show will touch. And so throughout our publicity and throughout reaching out at the state, we're hoping that people will be able to see why they should come and see this show. I see that it's a show that for someone who wants to know more about playwriting, they should come. I see that for people who like good theater, they should come. For people who are in these situations, whether they are the caregivers or perhaps the one who's facing death, they should come because they'll see themselves. And for those who just want to have an experience and get out of the house after all this COVID stuff, they should come.
Right.
One of the other things Barbara has done is find some generous sponsors to help underwrite this production. Mm-hmm. We got
Meredith Village Savings Bank, Curtis Quality Care, which is the only caregiving agency in the area that actually has certified death doulas who help the family and the individual get ready for the inevitable. And then we also have Home Instead caregiving agencies. And I've had personal experience with both of those agencies, although we have many wonderful ones in the area. But those agencies have helped my mother as she transitions from independent living to be able to have a rich life, but with more support.
So at least one of you, I think, has been through this end of life situation as a caregiver. Ms. Hill, you said you were a patient as well, right?
Right. I've been a caregiver of at the end of someone's life, and I was I had cancer 11 years ago, and twice they expected me to pass, and I managed to not, I guess, is the word to use.
Well, we are so grateful.
You must have a unique perspective on the subject, having been through it on both sides.
I think I do, and I think what that does for me is it helps me to understand people who are going through both sides. I have spent a lot of time kind of I don't know what the word, I want to say coaching, but just supporting people on both sides of that, caregivers and patients, to help them just, and this is just personally, not with any organization, mm-hmm. just helping friends and friends of friends and being there for them. And that's why I think this show is particularly good for people to see. It really is realistic, and well, some of them I don't know, because like the one about 9/11, obviously I would not know what that experience was, but the ones that I have kind of relate to me, I find them to be realistic and kind of heartwarming. And I know that's kind of odd, because people, like we said, don't have a good relationship with the end-of-life experiences in the United States, but these are just tender and funny, and I just think people will enjoy them, even though the main, what draws them all together, is end-of-life. It's not about dying. It's about how you lived and living.
Mm-hmm. And the good thing is, since they're only about 10 minutes long, if you don't like this one, just wait for the next one.
That's right.
Now, you had said that it's the seven scenes or acts, correct? Yep. And some of them had been written before. How did you stitch them all together into a coherent whole?
They're tied
together. Want to bring that a little closer to you, please?
They're tied together strictly by theme, just end-of-life scenarios.
Okay.
You know, we've got the 9/11 one. We've got a man attending a college reunion and meeting himself as a student in his earlier days. We've got an estranged father and son who are meeting for the first time in a couple of decades. We've got a man dying of cancer that Barbara referred to earlier, who's still smoking in secret. So there's all kinds of different setups and relationships that are going on in these various scenes, and they're tied together only by the fact that they're all related to the end of life in some way.
Okay, so it's not like a story.
No.
There's no happily ever after.
Well, it sometimes it is.
Oh,
well, you'd
have
to come see. But there's some precedents for this kind of show. A.R. Gurney wrote a play called The Dining Room, which was quite popular many years ago, which was just a series of scenes that take place among a family in a dining room, but at various points in the life of these characters. And John Cariani recently wrote something called Almost Maine, which has become very popular, which is just a bunch of scenes from a small town in Maine. And that's the only real relationship is the setting. So,
now you would, handout that you guys sent out, the press release, you had talked about how your writing involves getting holed up somewhere for a few days and just kind of pouring it all out. Is that what it kind of slowly drips in, and then eventually it has to move its way out?
Yeah, it builds up until I have to give it a release of some kind. I have a full-time job, so it involves writing, so there's not a lot of energy left over for creativity at the end of the day. So I tend to cogitate on concepts and ideas for a long time, and then when I do have some free time, or I grab some free time, I tend to run away and spare my wife my cursing and pen throwing. And I have some friends who have second homes that they're not using, or I'll just grab a motel room or something and do a 3 or 4 day weekend and get it all out, and then I have the luxury of picking away at it hour by hour when I have time. So.
When it comes out, it comes out in a rough form?
Yeah, very rough.
Right.
Yeah. I just do what I like to refer to as a brain dump. I just try to write it as fast as I can, get it all down. By the time I start writing, I have a structure in mind. I have the characters in mind. And then it's just a question of listening to them talk to each other in the particular situation that I've put them in, and just getting it all down on paper. And then I can go back, a week later, a few months later, and take a look at it in a different way and say, oh, that was a mistake. Let's see if we can't rewrite that.
We are talking today with Jay McNamee, who's a playwright here in New Hampshire, and from what you said, a Wolfboro resident?
New Durham resident.
Yeah. Okay. Kathleen Hill, who's the producer of the show called Dying with Laughter. The Village Players are doing it, and Barbara Wilson is with us as well. The play is going to be this weekend, Friday and Saturday nights, and a matinee on Sunday. Tickets are $20, and you can get them at the Village Players website, or you can get them at the door.
That's correct.
Village-players.com.
Okay. Now tell me, Kathleen, how did you get involved with this play and with the players?
Well, I became involved with the Village Players because I've been on and off doing theater with students. I've done student theater for 40
decades.
Years. Yes. There was an ad in the paper, probably an article in the paper, that the Village Players were doing Annie Get Your Gun. And I thought, well, that's got a lot of ensemble people. I think I'll go and audition. And got a small part, and I kind of fell in love with the Village Players because they're just really nice people, and they really work hard, and everyone's a volunteer. Everyone's on the same level, just working hard together to make something wonderful happen on stage. And so I've stayed. The way I got involved in this production is they asked me if I would be on the board, and I was elected to the board. And it was brought up at my first meeting in January that they wanted to do this. And to be honest, I had done a show very similar to this. I had directed one of the pieces. I did it with Powerhouse Theater over in Laconia. And we were talking about how we would do this. And it became evident that no one really had an idea because we're used to doing big, long plays. And I said, I've done this. I know exactly how we can do it. Which sort of turned into, okay, I'll be a producer if someone will help me because I'm in another play and I need somebody to help with a lot of that back behind the stage organization. I mean, everybody was like, okay, great, you know what you're doing, go for it. So that's how I ended up involved in this show.
What is it about plays and live theater that fascinates you so much?
Oh, my. I will say this, that to me, there is no more exciting moment than when you're sitting in an audience and the lights go down and they start to play the overture and you're just sitting there in anticipation of what's going to happen on that stage. And I get a similar feeling when that I am in a show and they say places, and it's you're just waiting for that curtain to open and start the show.
The thrill of the performance.
It's just very, it's just exciting. What I also love about theater is that I feel like there are some experiences, some stories that can only be told by watching people perform them. And I feel like this is one of those. When you say, oh, we did a reading, I think I know exactly why the Village Players said, no, we want to produce it. We don't want to just do a reading. Because I think this is one of those shows that it's going to be important to see those characters come to life. And not to disparage readings. Readings are great, but I just think there are some shows you need to see those characters. And when I read this one, I felt like we need to see these characters. We need to feel their emotions and their fears and their happiness come to life on stage.
And how, and a performance does that as opposed to the to a reading, which
well,
is more static, right?
Yeah, a reading is, I mean, I think many times when people do readings, they do some acting within the reading. It's not just standing there like, you know, a teacher reading a book in front of a class.
Right.
But I think that, you know, I just feel like there are some shows that deserve more than a reading. And I think this is one of those shows. I think part of it is the subject matter, but I also think part of it is the how those characters are reacting on the page will be much stronger when people are up there who've memorized the lines and have really talked about who these characters are. I mean, when I talk to the directors and the actors, they're doing a lot of work on that. Who are these characters? How are they reacting? How would they have reacted if they had other news? They're having all those deep discussions that you have when you do a full length play, and I think that just brings a lot to a show. And I talked to one director who said they called Jay to actually say, well, what were you thinking when you wrote this? And I've been able to do that, done a show with a playwright involved, and being able to talk to the playwright is so powerful, because sometimes a playwright will say, well, I was thinking that the character would be very angry at this point. Sometimes the playwright says, I wasn't really thinking anything. I just had these words I needed to get down. And that gives the director and the actors a lot of freedom to interpret. And both of those are really positive things to have as an actor and as a director.
That's Kathleen Hill. She's one of the producers of a new play coming to the Village Players. It's going to be called... I just had
Dying
it right here.
With
Thank
laughter.
You. Dying with Laughter. It's right there in front of me, and I couldn't see it. I think I have to clean my glasses. It's going to be this weekend, and Jay McNamee is with us as well, who wrote the play. Now, you've had your work performed before.
Oh, throughout my life?
Right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've had several productions, primarily in the northeastern part of the United States, mm-hmm. you know, Pittsburgh, Raleigh, Washington, D.C., but... New Hampshire's my home, and that's why I wanted to do it here first.
What is it about the writing process that fulfills you?
It's a tough question, because sometimes it's incredibly frustrating. But I think there's an old saw that says writers hate writing, but they love having written. And I think it's just that sort of sums it up. It's a struggle. And you're frustrated, but when it's all done, you feel as if you've really earned something and accomplished something.
Okay.
You know, it's like learning to shoot a free throw. You know, the first few times the ball falls short, and you just keep trying because you really want to sink that shot.
Let's talk a little bit about the Village Players and some of what they do and community theater in general. It's getting harder and harder to keep, you know, some of these companies alive. Financially, the Village Players seems to be doing very well in that respect. Everything is healthy and...
Well, I think that always, any kind of a nonprofit always has goals they want to attain and
sure.
money that they need to bring in to do those things.
Right.
But we are very blessed in that for the last 40 years, we have had boards at the Village Players who mm-hmm. Are forward-thinking. They bought what was the Masons Hall. Before that, it was a Universalist church right there on Glendon Street. The building was built in 1888, and through the really fabulous community that has embraced the theater, we've been able to renovate, keep it up, and continue to make it a building that can house not only our productions, but we can also bring in other community theaters. We have, what was the name of the production that Estelle Parsons helped us with a few years ago?
I'm not going to be able to pull that up, Barbara. I'm sorry.
And I can't either. Actually, Estelle Parsons, Oscar winner for Bonnie and Clyde, has had an interest in the theater for years, and she brought a company of actors who had been in prison previously and have put on productions about transitioning back into the traditional world to the Village Players. And we have been a venue for other nonprofits and theaters to be able to come to the theater too. But we are a cultural center, one of the many focuses or foci in Wolfboro. And we have, as Kathleen mentioned, we have a community of actors who come from all over the state, a community of people backstage from all over the state, from Laconia, from Dover, from Meredith, who come and put on productions together for the joy of it and for the joy of giving our audiences an experience.
Now, that being said,
yes,
I will say this. Last spring, we had a fire. And it damaged a small area in the theater, but of course there was smoke damage and all that throughout the theater. And while we do have insurance, and insurance paid the bulk of it, we did have some expenses that were not paid by insurance. And so that's one of the reasons we're having this fundraiser. And we've done a fundraiser to kind of help us cover those costs, kind of just a, hey, will you donate money, announcement at our productions. And we've had a lot of help from the community, many donations, but we could still use a little more.
Indeed.
Because we still have a few things we need to take care of. You know, in the, I don't know about you, but if you've ever been involved with a fire, it also, like, it also shows up the things that needed to be fixed that you didn't realize needed to be fixed, because now you have inspectors and people in your building. And so we're really trying to bring everything up to perfect to date, and so we just need a few dollars for that. So come on out and help us out.
Or if you can't make it to the production, you can make a donation to the theater directly.
Yep. And how could you do that?
You can do that by sending a check to our post office box that is listed on the Village Players, village-players.com website.
I believe that's box 770.
Oh, perfect. I'm glad he knows.
That's great. In Wolfboro.
Yes.
Box 770 in Wolfboro.
Yes, Wolfboro. 03894.
You can also donate at the website. So that's the easiest way. That's what I do.
Village-players.com. We're talking with three people today. Playwright Jay McNamee, Kathleen Hill, one of the producers of the play, Dying with Laughter. I don't know why I'm having trouble with that today. And Barbara Wilson of the Village Players is with us as well. And it's, how well do you guys get along with some of the other companies in town, like the Winnipesaukee Players, and you know, is it a community of theater groups?
Oh yes, I have to say I have been involved with four or five community theaters and professional theaters in New Hampshire, and what I will say is, you know, we're going to do Little Shop of Horrors, we need a dentist chair. You call around, somebody's got a dentist chair, they say, bring a truck, you can borrow it. Or one summer when we had done, the year before we had done Oklahoma, and then Interlakes Theater was doing Oklahoma the following summer, and I happened to talk to the owner there, and I said, well, we've got a bunch of costumes, and they sent a truck over, and picked up costumes and borrowed the costumes, because we have some wonderful costumers who make beautiful costumes. So our costumes are good enough to pass on to a professional theater company in Meredith. But It's the same thing with the Winnie Players. We've borrowed from them. In fact, the Village Players will lend to even the high school programs, mm-hmm. and people just work together. The Concord,
Concord Players,
Community Players of Concord. I think that's their official title. They lend all the time, and it's really nice. And I find that you can go from one, although the Village Players is my home, you can go from one company to another and fit in, because theater people are pretty welcoming to all kinds of people.
Mm-hmm. Is it, Barbara, you might be the best person to answer this. Is it difficult to get the number of volunteers you need, or do you not have that problem?
We always are looking for people, mm-hmm. because we want to bring more people into the community. And so if someone wants to audition for a show, they don't necessarily get a part or the part they wanted, we love to have them backstage. We also have very talented people who do a variety of things. So there are moments where someone says, hey, we need a producer. And Kathleen says, oh, I had a busy schedule, but I'll be your producer. So it works, but we always love to have more people.
Okay. And what are some of the things that a volunteer can do within the Players? I mean, besides the obvious acting and, you know, sets and costumes and lights and things like that.
Those are all things, but we also need people who will come and man the box office or usher or be out during intermission and serve the goodies that we have. Mm-hmm. We need people to do the publicity. We need people who are willing to come and clean up the theater before a show goes on. There's always something to do, and if you want to, there's always something to grow into, too. We do have productions coming up that we are in the midst of pre-production, such as Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, which will be our fall show. And Kathleen is going to be the director, along with Paul Stewart is going to be her co-director, who's also the one who's producing with her. We're looking for children from eighth grade up and adults of all ages and stages to be in that. And that has fabulous costumes and all kinds of lighting and excitement to do there. And we welcome people to join us.
And you're already planning it now. So
it's
a giant thing. Staging a play is not just a bunch of people getting together and going, all right, here's the script, let's go.
Right, it's not, I have some costumes and I have a barn like Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. It doesn't work that way.
Not at all. There's a meme out there. It's a picture of an iceberg that shows, you know, the it's a cross-section of an iceberg, and under the top is the final production, and the bottom underneath the water where the biggest part of the iceberg is, says rehearsal and, you know, whatever, the production process. It's huge behind-the-scenes work.
Oh, okay. I understand, Mr. McNamee, you have a time constraint?
I do. I have to head out in a couple minutes.
I understand. Yeah. But I appreciate you coming back. If you could just answer one more question.
Sure.
After the play, Dying with Laughter, you're going to be doing a Q&A with the audience?
Yes, we hope to have actors, directors, people from the Granite V&A who are going to talk about their mission and what they do and answer people's questions about any of the scenes they've seen or just end-of-life care in general.
Does people's reaction to your work inspire further work?
Yes.
It does.
Yeah, it feeds the soul.
You
know, when I get a laugh, when I intended a laugh, it's exactly, all right, I hit that one. And sometimes I get a laugh when I didn't intend to laugh, and I say, "Oh, I found a nickel. That's great."
I understand.
So it's very satisfying. I don't write novels; I write plays, so I need to hear an audience react to it.
All right. Well, I appreciate your time, Mr. McNamee. Thank you for being in here, ladies. You be able to stay with me for the rest of the hour?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much, Eric.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it, and best of luck, or as they say, break a leg, this weekend. Kathleen Hill is with me. Again, she's one of the producers of Dying with Laughter at the Village Theater in Wolfboro. It's coming up this weekend.
That's right. Friday at 7:30, Saturday 7:30, and Sunday at 2 p.m.
And How are ticket sales been so far?
So ticket sales have been slow, but what we have found in our experience and our history is that we don't really sell tickets until the week before, and then people, that's when people really mm-hmm. buy. So right. we anticipate that most of our tickets will be sold this week.
And ladies, how long have you been working on this play?
This one has been in production since January, not full-blown production because you start out just, okay, talking about your ideas and how you're going to be organized. I'd say full this one, because of the way it's being produced, so each little one act is its own play, so they have their own director and their own cast. They found their own times to rehearse, their own times to come. Some of them rehearse on Zoom first, and then they found time to come into the theater to rehearse. So it isn't the, like when you're doing a musical where you're rehearsing 3 days a week and everybody, it's kind of intense. A good intense, not in, but so I'd say that we really got going in April. So they've had about 6 weeks, which is a good amount of time because, like I said, they're only doing a 10-minute mm-hmm. one act each. And then we'll have a technical rehearsal tomorrow night, which is where we add the lights and the sound effects and anything, and we figure out how to move from one scene to the next as quickly as possible, and a dress rehearsal on Wednesday, and then a performance on Friday.
Interesting. Now, is it difficult? You said that Joseph and the Dream Coat is coming this fall. Mm-hmm. Obviously, one of the big expenses is royalties.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, especially for music, musicals and things like that. I imagine that the cost must be getting up there.
Do you want me to talk about that?
Sure, she's the director. So
royalties are our biggest expense, for sure.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yes. But what I will say this. Well, two things that help us. We're a relatively small theater, so that keeps our royalty costs down because they base a lot of how much you have to pay on how many seats you have.
Oh, okay.
We're a community theater. It's much, much more expensive for a professional theater. We try to be frugal with every other aspect of the show so that if royalties are expensive, then we try to cover those costs in another or make up for that in another way. I will say that, you know, it depends on what show you're doing, how high the royalties are. If you're doing an old show, they're not as high as if you want to do, well, I'll say Hamilton. No one can do Hamilton yet. It's still restricted, but you know, I'm sure when that is finally out, it'll be astronomical and very hard for a community theater to do. I think part of that is intentional because I think some shows they don't want community theater to do. They want, you know, they only want professionals to do it. And that's just part of how the publishers work.
Interesting. Interesting. We're talking with Barbara Wilson and Kathleen Hill. They're both involved with the Village Players. Ms. Hill, I want to talk to you a little bit about what this play is about. You had mentioned that you had faced life-threatening illnesses before. Without trying to bum you out, as it were, can you kind of take us through that time where the doctor sits down and says, here you go.
So, sure. I was diagnosed with cancer. I got the call from the doctor on a Thursday, and she said, I've got you in with the doctor at Dartmouth on Monday. And I knew immediately I was in trouble because I got into Dartmouth that fast. Before I could even get to Dartmouth, On the Sunday before the appointment, I threw a massive pulmonary embolism that straddled both of my lungs. And that was the first time they didn't think I would make it through the night. They were, get her family here. My family is spread out across the United States. And at that time, I had a brother in Thailand, and they said, get them here. She's not going to make it. Somehow I did. They didn't tell me I was going to make it. They told everyone else. I think they were afraid. They just didn't want to tell me. Anyway, what was interesting at that point was, like, I have five brothers, and they all came from wherever they were. And, you know, that's part of the positive part of, I don't know, end of life situations, where it, in my case at least, I get along very well with my brothers, and we're all very, we're spread out around the world, but we are very close. And so having that bring us together was such a positive aspect. And I don't know if we are, but we think we're hilarious. And so that, you know, we talked about how that sense of humor helps you get through tough situations. And so having them here was part of, when I say, you know, if you can't laugh, it really makes things tough. So that was a huge help. And then a few weeks later, when I was meeting with the oncologist, I said, I have a 13-year-old daughter. I need to know what you're talking about. Now, because I threw the pulmonary embolism, they couldn't do surgery, so they didn't know what was there. They started chemo first, and they were basing everything on imaging, and so they were sure it was stage 4 ovarian cancer, which is very, very bad news. And he said, they don't usually tell you anymore. I think back in the day they used to tell you 6 months or whatever. But I said, I need to know, because I need to make sure that where my daughter goes, my brother can get a bigger house, and, you know, just stuff like that. And, you know, there are those conversations that are hard. It's not all jokes and laughter. And, you know, the doctor said, you have a year. And my brother was with me, and he started to cry. And I said to him, nope, it's okay. It's okay. I'm going to make the most of this year. But the first thing I have to do is take care of business. I have to be sure that the money is going to the right place. I have to be sure that my brother, who was would be the legal guardian, would have what he needed to take care of things. I needed to have conversations with my daughter, which luckily I didn't have to have. But all those things I needed to have lined up. But in the midst of this, there were hilarious moments that, you know, are just, I mean, some of them probably are not appropriate for the radio, but there were just moments of, I still tell some of these stories because they are so funny, and they make you realize that even in the midst of impending death, there's hope, there's love, there's so much caring, and so much, I don't know, so much life left regardless of the illness.
Can you share one with us?
A story?
Yeah.
I will tell you this. This isn't actually a funny story, but I will say this. So I worked for the Interlake School District, mm-hmm. and I used to teach in North Conway, and I was very involved with the Village Players. And people from all three of those areas got together and said, how are we going to help them? And I will tell you, for 6 months, my brother, one of my brothers who was retired, came out and stayed with us. And we never cooked a meal unless we wanted to, because food came on a regular basis. I never had to feel lonely because people, I'm going to start to cry, because people were there and came to visit. People drove from, I lived in Center Harbor, and people drove from Conway, people drove from Rochester and Concord and up north, like at Plymouth, and all over the place to come and visit. And one of the principals I worked with called me and said, "I know you love my convertible. I'm picking you up at 2 o'clock and we're going for a drive." That kind of thing happened all the time. In fact, at one point, my brother started saying to people, "I'm timing you. You can stay for 30 minutes. Because when you stay for more than 30 minutes, she's exhausted. So we want to just, you know." Just one day, I got a call from the high school, and it was the home economics teacher who said, "Can I stop by and bring you some brownies the kids made for you?" And I said, "Sure, come on over." And she actually brought two of the kids who I had helped in an algebra class, which is ironic because my algebra is horrible, but they were kids who were sort of disengaged from school, and I kind of helped them, like, make sure they got to class and make sure they got stuff done, that kind of stuff. And they were with her, and they sat down and they talked to me. Such funny, lovely kids. And so all of those, I mean, I could tell you 1,000 stories. We could spend a whole hour on just this topic. I guess I'll tell you my funny story. My doctor gave me some, this was before marijuana was, you could get medical marijuana. I don't like know that much about it. But she gave me these pills, and she said they work like marijuana, and they'll keep you from getting nauseous, and they'll make you sleep. And my brother had to go back to Chicago for a while, so there were all these people around who were helping. And one day I decided I'm going to try one of these pills. I've never done any drugs, no pot, nothing. And I took this pill, and I'm sitting on the couch, and I all of a sudden I'm like, I don't think I can move. And so I was like bouncing my hands to make sure I could move my hands, and then bouncing my legs. And one of these women who were helping out walked by, stuck her face kind of in my face, and was like, "Kath, are you okay?" And I couldn't answer her because I was so, like, I was so, I don't know, I guess stoned, I'm not sure. But they thought I was having a seizure, and they called an ambulance.
Oh, no.
And but now all of this gets me, like, kind of worked up, and I finally said to a different friend who was riding in the ambulance with me, "I'm not having a seizure. I think I might be stoned." But none of them knew I took the pill. So they were all like, "What? No, you're not. No, you're not." Finally get to the hospital. They give me fluids. They make sure I eat. It's all, you know. And now it's worn off a little. And I finally, like, grabbed one of my friends by her shirt, pulled her in close to me and said, "There's nothing wrong with me. I was just stoned." And when my brother got back from Chicago, he said, Only you would end up in an ambulance because you've never been stoned before and you didn't know what was going on." So there's one of my silly stories.
We are talking with Kathleen Hill and Barbara Wilson, and they're both involved with the Village Players. When this play, Dying with Laughter, came to the Players, this must have been quite a, how did you feel when you saw this and said, "Oh"?
Well, so I think they actually had talked to Jay, I think, in December. Mm-hmm. So they all had a sense that it was not about dying, that it was more about the humor involved in end-of-life situations. So what I was like, at the first board meeting, when I got back on the board, I was like, what is this? And they were able to explain it to me. And I said, oh, this is a good idea. This is a great idea. And then shortly after that, I was able to read all the 7-1 acts, and I thought these are great. They're funny, they're heartwarming, they're touching. I was just in Steel Magnolias, which I don't know if you know the plot of that.
But
it's okay. So it's a similar kind of thing where it's okay, something very tragic happens, but through it all you're laughing. And I felt like this was in a similar vein. It's not that it's not all Southern women, but it's that whole sense of humor and laughing can keep you going. And I just said, this is a great idea. I think we should do this. And the fact that it's a fundraiser for not just the Village Players, but for Granite VNA is wonderful.
Which some people might not even realize what Granite VNA is. Granite VNA is the visiting nurses and hospice care. And we used to have our own VNA here, but they've just recently merged with Concord VNA.
Yeah, they've been on the show here before.
Excellent.
Nice people.
Oh, good. Yes.
Mm-hmm. In fact, they gave me my flu shot.
Oh, good.
Yeah, they do so many things that, you know, to support people at every stage of life, whether it's, you know, a baby who's coming home from the hospital prematurely, or it's someone who's just had a knee replacement.
I mean, they came and helped me when I had cancer. Mm-hmm. You know, so, yeah, it's a great organization.
All right. The play is coming up this weekend, Friday and Saturday at 7:30 and Sunday at 2 o'clock. Village-players.com is the website. Tickets are $20. You can buy them on the website or at the door. It should be a lot of fun. There'll be a question and answer session with the playwright as well. Ladies, thank you for being here. I appreciate you taking the time and break a leg, as the saying goes.
Thank you for inviting us.
Okay. News is next on WASR. It's 1 o'clock.